Okay. I really want to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful and prestigious place, and for giving me the chance to talk about some recent calculations that we made and investigations. I will talk about molecules in continuing, in a sense, along the lines that we just heard. And let me just remind you why we are, or I am interested in molecules. One thing is that in molecules, this is probably where we really want to know how charges move around. Atoms are maybe easier to understand, but molecules, we want to learn something new. We want to see, except for the charges, here implying electrons, we also want to see the nuclei moving, of course. We have seen nice first experiments there, both from the Canadian group and also from Imperial College. Of course, we would also like to know how photochemistry works. This is now both electronic excitations, electronic motion, and in the end, we would like to control it. Okay, this is all great wishes. Here there is one of the beautiful experiments along those lines where at least it was claimed that something was recovered that nobody ever had seen before, namely the highest occupied molecular orbital of N2. I put a question mark here because there is some skepticism what this is and to which extent it really has been seen. Anyway, this has set the stage of the kinds of things we would like to do. Now, from the point of interaction of the laser with the molecule, what's new? I would say the most important thing is the molecule is an extended object. It's not just a point with the all electrons sticking to it. It's something that has a structure. That means the electron cloud is larger, which was exploited in the talk just before, and which has other consequences. It means also that the excited electronic states are close by in general, so you can much more easily move electrons by a laser and get polarization, God knows what. Of course, you have a much more pronounced structure of the electronic wave function. It means you may have nodes, you may have very uneven distributions of the electronic charges, and you may orient this whole thing relative to your laser in various ways. And you have nuclear motions, but that's a different story about which I will not talk here. In this talk, I will restrict myself to the very, very simple things, in a sense, the ionization rates, maybe not as simple, the importance of correlation for ionization, and then something that is certainly very important, the way how electrons will go out, come back, and hit the original system. Now, let me start from the very elementary thing. It is always surprising to me how good ADK theory is. And this is an old calculation of us where, with Thomas Lovitz, and where we just looked at this, the exact hydrogen rates, the exact helium rates, and the dashed thing here is ADK, and these dotted lines give the barrier suppression threshold, and you see that below that threshold, it just works. It doesn't only work for this, it also works for funny models, like a 2D atomic model of argon. You understand on the next slide why I put it here, and you get almost perfect agreement if you do the three factors right, according to prescriptions. The agreement is roughly on this level of 10%. And the surprising thing here is that the only thing that enters into this ionization rates is the field-free electron wave function. So the system, there's kind of a first-order effect. The system doesn't know much about the external field. Just to remind, for if there is anybody who doesn't know what ADK is, you stitch together the field-free wave function with the WKB solution at the right place, which is somewhere under the tunnel barrier. That's it. It's a Frankenstein wave function. Okay, now ionization. How good is it for molecules? And there has been a beautiful contribution by Xiaoming Tong and Sironi, which is just taking this idea one step further and doing this stitching on a somewhat more complicated object, comparing, and here I have a comparison just for you, again a reminder, at now the field strength is given relative to the barrier suppression field strength, and you see the blue is the ADK rate, the red is for different directions of the external electric field is the exact complex scaling calculated rate for two-dimensional models. This is why I wanted to show first that this works also for atoms, where it works really nicely. And here it doesn't work there. It works within a factor of two. I must say that there is it's not always very clear how to really do this. You know, there's a certain freedom to do this stitching. And if you play with this, but there's no good reasons. When you do it in a naive way, you end up with something like this. So when the field strength is small enough, say about half the barrier suppression field strength, you still get the right rates. All of this is of course a single electron model, and I want to make a brief excursion now to what happens when there is more than a single electron. And for that I use a method that we have developed over the last few years, and Thomas has given an introduction to this yesterday, so I make it very briefly just to remind you. We go beyond the single active electron approximation by using the MCPDHF multi-configuration time-dependent Hartree-Fock method. What is this? You take determinants, Slater determinants, capital Phi, and you make a linear combination of those Slater determinants with linear partial coefficients, and both the determinants and the expansion coefficients are made to be time-dependent. To be more precise, not the determinants, but single electron orbitals that compose the determinants are each time dependent, and everything is kept to be optimal in the sense of some variational principle. Not very important what it really is. The main thing is by doing this in terms of single electron orbitals, one gets a comparatively compact representation of the total wave function. In principle, this is complete. So if we could do all the numerics and if we had the big computers, we could go to very large numbers of the individual orbitals and we would retrieve the exact result. So we can systematically study whether we are anywhere close to correlation or something like that. We can do, I mentioned this here explicitly, we can do superposition states, which is important for strong ionization, for example. It means part of the wave function is in bound situation, part of the wave function is in ionizing situation. This is something that it can do it's very difficult to do in single configuration Hartree-Fock. In multi-configuration, it's done there by definition. It's also difficult to do, as I understand, in things like time-dependent density functional theory. And you can systematically include the correlation starting from a Hartree-Fock, which by definition would be uncorrelated, going to a correlated calculation. These advantages don't come for free. The equations of motions are nonlinear. We have non-local operators, which is really not very pleasant to do for calculations. There is a general disadvantage for this kind of expansions that they are not very good for hard electron-electron collisions. The reason is when two electrons that are kind of anchored on the nucleus approach each other, this coordinate is important, and we must model this coordinate by moving these large coordinates, and that makes it difficult. You need very long expansion. That's maybe part of why you cannot do, Thomas pointed out, why it's difficult to do two-dimensional correlated spectra in double ionization. Okay, where do we apply, or what is it meant to be applied to ionization? In the first place, quasi-bound state dynamics, which means that it's dynamics of states that have the correct character of bound state, but are moving somewhat in time. Single electron spectra, when you emit one electron. And I want to mention here also more general systems. The method is implemented, it does not rely on anything being Coulomb here, so we apply to quantum dots. At present, we have done up to 6 active electrons in a cylindrical symmetric situation with a few cycle laser pulses at realistic parameters. we use about 1,000 of these later determinants, and it runs for quite a while on a big computer. It's parallel that makes it survive. Otherwise, this would be 300 hours roughly, and that's too long. But computers are getting more and more, so we can do things like that. And just to give you a feeling how good we get with this system here, here is the H2 energy for the clamped nuclei at the H2 neutral equilibrium position. And here you get, this is the number of particles, it's 2 electrons, and we increase the orbital to 8, and we get something like convergence in the electron energy. This is, never mind what this number is, this is the electronic energy, the repulsion is missing here. This is the corresponding exact value. So we are approaching this. So we're modeling realistic systems. We're not doing really chemical accuracy here, but that's, I think, not the point. Now let us, using this method, let us look at how important correlation is for ionization. We have models now of argon quote and N2 quote, which means that there are 2 active electrons. We have adjusted some heuristic potential such that we have the right ionization potential, and we fixed the internuclear separation at something that is close to the N2 internuclear separation, and we have a laser pulse that looks like that. And here is the numbers that we get. This is, to be more precise, it's ground state depletion. In single active electron models, we get 4% for argon and 7% for N2. This is some model. In Hartree-Fock, it's smaller. Here it's smaller, here it's bigger. And when you look at argon, it doesn't look like convergence. This is nothing that I would call convergence. I don't know when we go down here where it would end up. If you look at N2, this looks a lot better. Now, what's going on here? This seems to imply that there are strong multi-electron effects in total ionization. And it's on the same scale, the problem is on the same scale for atoms and molecules. If anything, it's worse in an atom. Now, this is why I told you the ADK story before. If you look at the electron density that we calculate with this method at larger distances, then we have here, the ratio between the best calculation, n is 8 orbitals, and the other calculations. So this is 1. And we see that this relatively slowly converges at larger distances to the exact value. Hartree-Fock green is rather often than we start converging, and corresponding to that, although not really proportional to that, we get correct or converged results. Also note that the single electron model has actually the overall correct asymptotic behavior, but it's off by a factor. So the message here is what we need. We need to make sure that whatever we do, if we want to predict an ionization, we need to be sure that the asymptotic part, that is, asymptotic means somewhat outside the bound part of our wave function, is properly represented. Now, this is actually not a problem of the basis that we're using. This is the problem of the optimization principle we are using. We are optimizing for energy, and we're not optimizing for the accuracy of the wave function. That's why the accuracy is not very good. Okay. Let us continue to with a theme that has been very important, has popped up all over during this meeting, that is recollision of electrons. This is a symbolic picture for what's going on. I don't need to say anything with this. But I want to ask, now, what is the current that really comes back? What is the current in terms of when does it come back, in terms of at which momentum does it come back, beyond that classical picture? And the first problem here is that we must ask, what does this mean? Because, as it was mentioned somewhere in the beginning of this conference, it is Schrödinger cat something. It's a different electron, but it's the same electron. That means it's coherent, it interferes, it does all kinds of things. How do we separate these two parts? And if once we have answered this question, whether it's a meaningful concept, which can be done in a reasonable approximation, we should answer, how does this current depend on the host systems, the Hooke's molecule. The problem is that we always think in classically here, but it's a quantum process on at least two levels. One thing is the ionization is rather quantum. The other thing is this interference and distinction between the free and bound electron in the quantum must be looked at from a quantum point of view. And we must find out how to separate electrons that make this pass and come back from electrons that always stayed here. There is no unambiguous distinction in terms of states, of quantum mechanical states, in terms of spectra of some Hamiltonian, because there is no fixed Hamiltonian of which we can take the spectra. So we always get artifacts when we do that. So how do we solve this? We solve it just as we think of it originally. That is, we think of an electron going out. So we only look at the electrons that do go out. So we take a solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which incidentally is the one for N2, for this N2 model. And this is actually contrary to the previous talk. This is a very tiny part of the wave function that we're looking at. That's what's really being used in these resketching electron experiments. It's 10 to the minus 4 of the maximum amplitude of the wave or intensity or electron density. And then we put the watchtower, a probe function, say M, which would be a Gaussian or something. And we multiply our wave function with this and look what remains. What remains is a blob like this, which now goes back and scatters from what is left here. So this is our taking this at a couple of times, integrating it over time, we get the current as it is seen here next to the molecule. You see it scattering here. You see actually also that there is serious scattering for rather large distances, which also should make you think about the plane wave approximation for this. And you see distortions very early on in this. Okay, you can do this propagation quantum mechanically, you can also do it classically. I will show you that this doesn't make a difference in principle. Now, that's a nice idea. Does it work? We look at the current on target, that is on some plane, that is where we have the molecule. But we take now three different distances at which we probe our electrons, and what you see is you get three different rescattering times. Now, there is no mystery to that. The point is that the excursion amplitude is correlated with the momentum at which you rescatter. So the further out you go, the higher the momentum at which you rescatter, basically. So the red curve is taken at 10, so we get a lot of them. So we get all momentum up from here. The next curve in green is taken at 15. Now, if we restrict in our probe here the momenta to 15, the red curve and the green curve coincide. And also, when we go further out, the same again, all three curves now coincide. This is now we get only the top portion of the momenta here. There is another artificial thing in our in our method, that is that this probe has a weak. But this is not a very dramatic influence. Here you have three different probe widths, and you see that you get pretty much the same structural target. So the final remark, we probe the electrons, and now we propagate, after probing, we propagate them quantum mechanically or classically, and it doesn't make a difference. So this is really, this also implies that we have only one trajectory, so to speak, for our electrons. So, The bottom line is that this probing at the distance gives a reasonable picture of what the recollision current is. So that way we can make this concept somehow more precise. And now let us look what happens. Let's go back to our argon and N2 model. Let's look what happens to the probed current. This is now the current through the probe at different times. For our model systems, which I have introduced before, it's argon and N2, that is two centers or one, and what we see is, okay, we have different ionization rates for the two systems, but we have essentially, except for this overall normalization, we have essentially the same shape. So this seems to imply that this is a rather universal process, this ionization is common. Now, however, we have here always aligned the axis with the laser polarization. or with the laser field. And that's, of course, a problem. Now, why do we do this? The reason is that that's the only thing we can do, cylindrical symmetry in full correlation UD. So let's see whether we need, to which extent for this phenomenon, we need full correlation. And for that, we have looked at the worst case at argon, and again, compensate for different total yields between the Hartree-Fock and the quite strongly correlated calculation. Again, we see pretty much the same picture for both calculations. So for this question, at least, single active electrons model should give good qualitative results, and we can go back to the single electron calculation. Now we are back at our two-dimensional single active electron calculation. We have a Girard-type orbital on something that, again, models something like 2 or so. Not so important. The main point is we turn it around, we see the current parallel, the momentum distribution parallel to laser polarization looks nice and smooth. It has different size because the ionization depends on orientation, of course. But that's it. It's the same shape. Nothing dramatic seems to happen. When we look at the perpendicular momentum distribution, again, it looks rather good, except that this thing in the middle here at 45 degrees seems to be tilting somewhat. And that's not, that is indeed something real that happens here, because, which we see much more dramatically in this case, we have now put an ungeraded type of orbital on top, something with a node in between. And we, again, we turn the molecule, we ionize, we look at the momenta parallel. It doesn't look bad. It looks smoothly. The orientation dependence of the total yield is more pronounced, which is consistent with the molecular ADK. But when we look at the perpendicular orientation of perpendicular momenta, it looks bad. We have either a single hump or a double hump with the zeros missing. It's actually very simple, and this is a symmetry. This appears for symmetry reasons. You get an immediate result from ADK. It tells us that if we have things like that, if we have this structure, then this structure will reappear in one way or another in the rescattering electron spectra. What does this lead to? Again, the now this is as a function of time and the space now. What I showed you before is momentum. What does this mean in terms of space? That is, where on target do the electrons arrive? When we have parallel alignment, we get a rather nice distribution as a function of time. So we are pretty much hitting our system head on. When you have perpendicular alignment, we get a series gap in between here. Now, just on the next plot, that's the same plot as before, just one cut through this line. And this is how big our molecule is, and this is where the electrons go. So, in this case, most electrons will miss the target. This is obviously a strongly orientation-dependent effect, and it has a lot of consequences for if you want to reconstruct an image. We really don't the way the electrons return. Another thing is that we can really not deduce, as it was done, total ionization from rescattering, say, ionization on of molecules. Because we simply don't know how, even if we, so if there's one thing is the rate with which the electrons go out, the other thing is how efficiently the rescatter ionize our molecules. There's another thing when we look at the orientation dependence of the timing. And this is now the current through the probe plane as a function of time for a rather large system. This is done to enhance the effect. Yeah. For a rather large system, but that's not large for a real molecule. And we turn this thing around and we see that at 0 degree, electrons come later as compared to 90 degrees. Now, I must admit that my original message with this was just, be cautious, think what's happening. Yesterday we heard this talk, beautiful talk by Hamid Meraji, and there was a graph that struck me. And I asked him for the slide and just show you this graph. This were, you remember the interpretation, it could be interpreted as when electrons of that energy return to the nucleus. And they see an orient, this is CO2, has nothing to do with our model, but we see an energy dependence, orientation dependent lag of these two responses. I don't know quite what to make of it, but it seems to indicate that that could be a similar process. I must admit, we didn't analyze why this time dependence happens in our case, and maybe should be cautious in interpreting this, but I think this again tells us we must take these structural effects in ionization, we must take these effects into account. Well, what are the consequences for this beautiful idea of rescattering imaging? I would say if we don't know the initial orbital, this is what we want to measure, we do not know the momentum rescattering, spectra. So this is a, we don't know our probing beam because it originates from what we want to learn. On the other hand, if harmonics are sensitive in one way or another to the initial orbital, there is this information. However, it cannot be extracted as easily as it was said before. The first, I don't know whether it's very smart, maybe there is a smart idea, but the first idea that comes, of course, is, well, do it iteratively. Build a reasonable model, which you can trust, which you first should analyze, and adjust to the measured spectra. That's, of course, quite a difference to the tomographic reconstruction algorithm that was proposed. On the other hand, I think imaging, really imaging such systems, might be worth the effort. In any case, we will have a strong theory-dependent interpretation of measurements, and we need good numerics and or analytic models. Good numerics, if anything, to check the analytic models. Summary, total ionization is understand on a level that which we're qualitatively happy with, I would say. Correlation for this particular case is, in my opinion, a rather secondary effect. We should first worry about the single electron effect. Rescattering electrons can be defined in a reasonably consistent way by just picking up the idea literally and say, let's just look which electrons have gone out in transaction, look only at those. And we can see that they are basically classical, but they are not universal. We don't know their momentum distribution, we don't know their time distribution. And therefore, I would say that rescattering imaging, if it is to survive, needs a joint effort of theory and experiment. Okay, I finish with thanking the people who did this, Xinhua Xie, who is doing the rescattering calculation, Gerald Jordan, who is the chief engineer of NCTDHF, which is really hard computer software engineering, and Marlene Wickenhauser, who joined us recently and who is starting with doing this nice 2D calculation.
So, thank you very much for the contribution. We have quite some time for questions.
Not so much a question as a comment. I agree, of course, with your conclusions, as you know. I think things are perhaps more hopeful even than what you suggest, because what we really want to do with this rescattering imaging is get the dynamics of changes, and so we don't we know the start point, and hopefully we already know the structure to begin with, so that gives us a fixed point at the start of any calculation, and then what we're looking for is changes in some sort of pump probe scenario that will allow us then to track this any major signatures in the structural change. So I think in that sense, of course, we still need detailed calculations and correct calculations, but I think the project, as it were, is still on track for doing dynamic imaging of structural change.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I had here in mind this, if you know your structure, if you know your electronic structure reasonably well, that's good. I had in mind essentially imaging, of course. If you don't know it, it's even better.
With the present point of the method, how far away is one from describing non-sequential double ionization?
I must admit, I don't consider this as a real target for this. I think there is a chance to, I think Thomas has made the point, there is a chance to do total yield. I think there is, as far as we know from the numerical simulations, these electrons go out correlated over a long distance. So you, if you think of Thomas's plots yesterday, there was the last plot was exact calculation. And you saw a structure that went just diagonally to the coordinates. That means in a method that any method that depends on a product expansion into single electron functions, you need a lot of functions to represent these structures. You will never do this. If you say you don't care what it does once it's out, so you only need it when it leaves the molecule, the atom or so, there's a chance to do it. I don't know how well it will converge in the end. On the other hand, I think this is a problem that haunts any calculation unless, like Taylor does, if you really do this. Brutal thing. So that's okay.
Thanks. Further questions?
Oops. Keeps me moving.
So could you elaborate a little bit more on really what is the goal of doing this? I mean, so the double ionization is not, but I mean, you want to do lots of electrons. Is it the effect of correlation on the ionization rate, or what are you really aiming for
here? I think the important target is the dynamics in the system, that is, in the bound situation. There we should be fine. That is a not very hard collision, relatively average situation. However, a situation where you get that you would describe as a superposition of a couple of spin free states, for example. And yes. Yes. Yeah. Like Roger and. Right. This kind of situation.
Maybe I have a question. For analyzing this ionization process, can you calculate electron emission spectra for different targets? I mean, wouldn't that be the first step to understand what kind of wave functions you produce?
Yes. Is the single electron emission is rather predictive. So for this can be done. The point is, right now we don't have, I showed you H2. We are not, the situation that is interesting is the strong field situation. So we cannot compete at the moment with, say, taking a field-free state and then taking a single photon transition. There you take a good field-free state from quantum chemistry. So the interesting situation occurs when the whole thing really gets distorted seriously by the laser power. And we have done this in 1D, and we could demonstrate convergence for the spectrum. And yes, that's the target.
Okay, I don't see any further questions, so let's thank the speaker again. And now we have a short break, as I understand, so we go out and...